Good morning. Today we're going to have a look at Deuteronomy. By way of introduction, I'd point out that understanding the New Testament in light of the Old Testament is more important than understanding the Old in the light of the New. At the time of Jesus, what we call the Old Testament today, well, that was all they had. Okay, and so it's important to understand the Old Testament in its own right, and that's the approach that we're going to be taking. So where does Deuteronomy fit? Well, the two books that come before that is Leviticus and Numbers, and the two books after Deuteronomy, of course, is Joshua and Judges. In Leviticus, Israel had been brought up out of Egypt to meet with God at Mount Sinai, and there God gives them the law. In Numbers, you might remember, it's all about the grumblings, mostly, the grumblings of the Israelites in the wilderness. Deuteronomy is a renewal of the covenant. This is 40 years after Sinai. Joshua is about the conquest of the promised land. And in Judges, there's another generation that's passed, and Israel again sins against the Lord. And God tests them with the nations that he didn't destroy under Joshua. So what's the summary and the takeaway of all of this, of Deuteronomy that we're going to conclude with? Well, much of Deuteronomy mirrors other books of the Pentateuch, the five books of Moses, and particularly Leviticus. So what do we take away from Deuteronomy that's particular to this book? Well, one aspect of Deuteronomy is that it recounts the time just before the people of Israel move across the Jordan River to commence taking over the promised land, the land that God had promised to them. And it's important to have an understanding of how this fits in to God's plan, because it reinforces important principles about the nature of God. Now, the reason why God was going to give the Israelites this land was because he had chosen them as his special people. And they were going to be a nation, and a nation needs to have somewhere to live. So the reason why he was going to have them forcibly drive out another group of people was the simple fact that the other people were wicked and sinful before God. They had degenerated to dreadful savagery, and God had decided that this was going to be his judgment on them. The timing of the conquest was driven by the state of the development of the sin of the people they were going to drive out. So from the time of Abraham, God knew that these people that currently occupied that land, they were only going to get worse and worse in their behaviour, but that he was going to wait until their punishment was well and truly due before executing judgment on them through his people, the Israelites. So this is the big picture. This is the context of what God is doing, about the why, the wherefore, the timing of it all. So key principle here is that God didn't give the Israelites the promised land because they were good. They weren't. He gave it to them because he promised it to Abraham. He made a promise to Abraham that he was going to do this. So God was keeping his promises. Another key principle is that God hates sin and wickedness and will ultimately execute judgment on it. Most of all, though, is to understand and focus on what God expects of his people. And key to all this is that the promise that God demands of his people is not distant or difficult. So there's a number of different aspects of what I want you to take away from Deuteronomy, but this is the conclusion of it. And we're going to read from Deuteronomy 30, 11 to 14. Now, what I am commanding you today is not too difficult for you or beyond your reach. It is not up in heaven so that you have to ask who will ascend into heaven to get it and proclaim it to us so that we may obey it. Nor is it beyond the sea so that you have to ask who will cross the sea to get it and proclaim it to us so we may obey it. No, the word is very near you. It is in your mouth and in your heart so that you may obey it. See, I set before you today life and prosperity, death and destruction. For I command you today to love the Lord your God and to walk in obedience to him and to keep his commands, decrees and laws. Then you will live and increase, and the Lord your God will bless you in the land you are entering to possess. But if your heart turns away and you are not obedient, and if you are drawn away to bow to other gods and worship them, I declare to you this day that you will certainly be destroyed. And so on it goes. And we'll come back to that again later. But the key point there is that what God is commanding of his people, and this is much of what Deuteronomy is about, is God's commands to his people, saying it's not difficult, it's not distant, it's not removed from you, it's not abstract, it is near to you. And that really is the gospel message. So, let's have a look at Deuteronomy in some more detail. A bit more introduction first. Style. The style of Deuteronomy is largely a record of a series of addresses by Moses. And it's mostly a first-person record. As you read through the Bible from Genesis through Leviticus, there's a marked difference in tone when you get to Deuteronomy. It's a bit like the difference between spoken and written speeches. And of necessity, the way we speak and the way we write tends to be different. It's just an artifact of language. And that's a little bit like Deuteronomy, in that Deuteronomy is written differently from the other books. It's personal, it's reflective, and in much of it is in the first person. Just going to talk a bit, just briefly, about the question of the date of writing, of when it was written. Back in the 18th and 19th centuries particularly, it was common for liberal scholars to confidently assert that all of Deuteronomy was written around the time of King Josiah, or thereabouts, some 7 to 9 centuries after the time of Moses. And even today, you might even come across people who still will make that claim. But it's a pretty serious claim to make, and not one that should be taken as a possible option. And I'll explain why. So, as I said, much of Deuteronomy is written in the first person by Moses. Chapter 1, verse 9, at that time I said to you. Chapter 9, verse 13, and the Lord said to me. Now, some of the parts of the book were obviously added later. They weren't written by Moses because they described things after the death of Moses. But to claim that the entire book was written by someone else many centuries after the events is to claim that the document is a fraud, a fake. And that's a pretty serious assertion to make. Now, Deuteronomy 31 verse 9 mentions that Moses wrote down the laws that God gave him, and he entrusted the record to the priests. Exodus 24 verse 4 also says the same thing, that Moses wrote it all down. Hence, again, to claim that none of the Pentateuch, being the first five books of the Bible, existed in written form until many centuries after the events is to flatly contradict what the text says. So it's okay to have differing views on debatable details of the Bible. That's okay. But what I'd suggest is to be very wary of ideas that have the effect of discrediting the document to the extent of making it fraudulent. So I'm not going to go into all the details of the claims and the counterclaims of these issues. You can read that for yourself in the commentaries. But needless to say, if Deuteronomy was a fraud, then it wouldn't be in our Bibles today. So, enough said about that. Themes, a thematic outline of Deuteronomy. So, could be arranged like this. Yahweh, Lord of the Covenant, Lord, King, Judge, Warrior, God performed mighty acts for Israel, and in return he demanded their obedience. Yahweh, their God. Secondly, Israel as the people of the covenant. So there's the God of the covenant and there's the people of the covenant, and they are obligated to serve their God Yahweh exclusively. That's the deal. Thirdly, the worship of God. What's the nature of it? What's it based on? It's based on love and gratitude. It's by personal devotion, as well as there's a range of festivals and rituals. Last theme is Yahweh as the God of history, and this is something we're going to bring out today as well. God is the God of history, able to fulfill his purpose. So there's a bit of a thematic outline of the book that we're very roughly going to follow. So first of all, the covenant. Yahweh is the Lord of the covenant and Israel is the people of the covenant, and worship of God being based on love and gratitude. Deuteronomy is concerned with covenant relationship between God and his people. God had made a deal with the people, and they had agreed with it wholeheartedly. Okay, this wasn't a one-way deal, it was reciprocal. And from time to time, that agreement's renewed, like it is in chapter 29. Deuteronomy recounts how the people are called to total commitment under the agreement they have with God. Now, the book does retell and rearrange things slightly for the circumstances compared to some other parallel records. There are some parallel records in different books, and in Deuteronomy there are some slight differences. That's okay. So a key point is that God commands obedience. If we have a look at chapter 4, verses 1 to 3. Now, Israel, hear the decrees and laws I'm about to teach you. Follow them so that you may live and go in and take possession of the land that the Lord, the God of your ancestors, is giving you. Do not add to what I command you and do not subtract from it, but keep the commands of the Lord your God that I give you. You saw with your own eyes what the Lord did at Baal Peor. The Lord your God destroyed from among you everyone who followed the Baal of Peor. So he says, now Israel, hear these decrees. And by the way, that Baal Peor refers back to an event that's recounted in Numbers chapter 25, which you can read about. So while God commands obedience, first and foremost, the people of God are to love their God. And we see that in chapter 6. We'll read from verses 4 to 9. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength. These commandments that I give you today are to be on your hearts. Impress them on your children. Talk about them when you sit at home and when you walk along the road, when you lie down and when you get up. Tie them as symbols on your hands, bind them on your foreheads, write them on the door frames of your houses and on your gates. Now, verses 4 and 5 of what I've just read, you might recognise as one of the two passages that were quoted by Jesus in response to the question about which are the greatest commandments. Remember, it was recorded, people came to him and said, what are the greatest commandments? And this was one of two things that he responded with. The other verse was Leviticus 19:18, to love your neighbour as yourself. So this is quite a significant passage. And it's more significant than that because this first passage from Deuteronomy 6 is very familiar to all pious Jews. It would have been in Jesus' time because it's central to the Jewish prayer book. Deuteronomy 6:4-9 is the first of three passages that form the Hebrew Shema. Shema is the Hebrew word for hear, which is the first word of this passage. And the second passage is Deuteronomy 11:13-21. So if you faithfully obey the commands I am giving you today to love the Lord your God and to serve him with all your heart and with all your soul, then I will send rain on your land in its seasons, both autumn and spring rains, so that you may gather in your grain, new wine and olive oil. I will provide grass in the fields for your cattle, and you will eat and be satisfied. Be careful, or you will be enticed to turn away and worship other gods and bow down to them. Then the Lord's anger will burn against you, and he will shut the heavens so that it will not rain, and the ground will yield no produce. And you will soon perish from the good land the Lord is giving you. Fix these words of mine in your hearts and minds. Tie them as symbols on your hands and bind them on your foreheads. Teach them to your children, talking about them when you sit at home and when you walk along the road, when you lie down and when you get up. Write them on the door frames of your houses and on your gates, so that your days and the days of your children may be many in the land that the Lord swore to give your ancestors, as many as the days that the heavens are above the earth. So God calls his people to be separate, to be devoted to him. And in chapter 18, verse 9, it says, when you enter the land the Lord your God has given you, do not learn to imitate the detestable ways of the nations there. And so this is a repeated theme that comes out through the whole book. So bound up in the covenant, the deal between God and his people, is the fact that God is Lord, he's King, he's Judge, but he's also a warrior on behalf of the people, and he would fight for them. And God, up to this time, has done incredible things, and he would continue to do incredible things. But he demands obedience from the people. The people of Israel are obligated to serve their God, Yahweh, exclusively. And getting that bit wrong was no trivial matter that God would just benignly overlook. And most of all, the worship of God is based on love and gratitude. So as we saw in those first few verses of chapter 4, a theme that is repeated over and over, this covenant deal involves God promising the people that they will have territory to occupy, in other words, somewhere to live. And part of the nature of God is that he is God of history. He has purposes and he will fulfill them. And that is what we see in this book, which describes what happens next, which is the book of Joshua. That's what that's all about. But for now, we're going to have a look at some more aspects of Deuteronomy that revolve around these themes of the covenant, the obedience and worship of God. Let's just turn now and have a look a bit at the characteristics of the law. There's a lot of giving of laws and things. So what's particular about them that we should note? Much of Deuteronomy, it's about these various laws, and they do have some distinctive characteristics. One of those things is that they are directive rather than causative. Directive being, do this, don't do that. Chapter 16, verse 19 and following. Do not pervert justice or show partiality. Do not accept a bribe. So this is directive as opposed to causative, which is if, then. And this, most of the laws are framed in this way. And what we can glean from that is that these instructions are from God himself, not from man. Other characteristics of God's laws are that they are fair, they are ethical, and they are humanitarian. And in particular, they showed care for the defenceless. And this was apparently quite unique in that region and that time. So let's have a look at Deuteronomy chapter 24, verse 6. Do not take a pair of millstones, not even the upper one, as security for a debt, because that would be taking a person's livelihood as security. And then in verses 17 to 19, further down, do not deprive the foreigner or the fatherless of justice, or take the cloak of a widow as a pledge. Remember that you were slaves in Egypt, and the Lord your God redeemed you from there. That is why I command you to do this. When you are harvesting in your field and you overlook a sheaf, do not go back to get it. Leave it for the foreigner, the fatherless, and the widow, so that the Lord your God may bless you in all the work of your hands. And in that last verse, by the way, that's very significant when we get to the book of Ruth. So the laws are fair and they're ethical. Chapter 15, verse 7 and 8. If anyone is poor among your people in any of the town of the land that the Lord your God is giving you, do not be hard-hearted or tight-fisted toward them. Rather be open-handed and lend them whatever they need. From Deuteronomy 19:15, we learn that under God's laws, one witness is not sufficient. One witness is not enough to convict anyone accused of any crime or offence they may have committed. A matter must be established by the testimony of two or three witnesses. The laws are humane. 25, verse 3. But the judge must not impose more than 40 lashes. If the guilty party is flogged more than that, your Israelite neighbour will be degraded in your eyes. The laws were classless. The same rules applied to everybody from top to bottom. That might seem inconsequential or not of great note to us, but it makes more significance when you compare it to some other laws of the day. So what really brings home the distinctiveness of the laws of God through Moses is actually to read some other ancient law codes as comparison and compare them, and then it all starts to become clearer how significant these laws are. Another set of ancient laws that we have a record of, quite famous, is the laws of Hammurabi. So we're going to have a look at some of those. Hammurabi's law number 9. If anyone steals cattle or sheep, an ass or a pig or a goat, if it belongs to a god or to the court, the thief shall pay 30-fold. If they belong to a freedman of the king, he shall pay 10-fold. If the thief has nothing with which to pay, he shall be put to death. So note that different punishments apply depending on what class the victim belongs to. Lower class people in Hammurabi's day had fewer protections under law than did higher class people. Hammurabi number 202. If anyone strikes the body of a man of higher rank than he shall receive 60 blows with an ox whip in public. 203. If a freeborn man strikes the body of another freeborn man of equal rank, he shall pay 1 gold mina. So we can see these class, different rules for different classes come out quite clearly, and it seems evident also, apparently, that one witness is sufficient for judges to make a determination. Let's have another look at another one, number 26. If a chieftain or a man who has been ordered to go upon the king's highway for war does not go, but hires a mercenary, if he withholds the compensation, then shall this officer or man be put to death, and he who represented him shall take possession of his house. Notice what this implies. Someone who was conscripted for military service, if they were rich enough, they could pay someone else to go in their place. That was apparently quite acceptable, quite normal. Wealth could buy exemption from military service. Interestingly, God's rules about military service for the ancient Israelites were very generous. But they were generous to the ordinary person as opposed to the merely wealthy. Let's have a look at Deuteronomy 20, verses 5 to 8. The officers shall say to the army, "Has anyone built a new house and not yet begun to live in it? Let him go home, or he may die in battle and someone else may begin to live in it. Has anyone planted a vineyard and not begun to enjoy it? Let him go home, or he may die in battle and someone else enjoy it. Has anyone become pledged to a woman and not married her? Let him go home, or he may die in battle and someone else marry her." Then the officers shall add, "Is anyone afraid or faint-hearted? Let him go home, so that the others will not become disheartened too." Further along in 24 verse 5, "If a man has recently married, he must not be sent to war or have any other duty laid on him. For 1 year he is to be free to stay at home and bring happiness to the wife he has married." So notice that all these things are generous to the ordinary person as opposed to being generous to the people of high rank or wealth. And so we can see the distinctiveness of the laws of God and how incredibly advanced they were when we compare them with other laws. Now, when studying the laws of the Old Testament, it's essential to make a distinction between the transgression and the punishment. They're two very different things. The transgression is the thing that the person did wrong. The punishment is the punishment. And that's the same with our laws today. You get convicted of an offence and the sentencing is a separate exercise. So different transgressions had different levels of punishment. It's quite interesting to lay them all out and see the different levels of punishment. It tells you a lot. Now, the punishments themselves might not be transferable out of the context of ancient Israel, but the transgressions largely are. What was a transgression before God then is still a transgression before God now. And even though most people won't acknowledge it, the fact is that they form the basis of moral principles throughout the Western world in particular today. Our laws don't find their origins in Hammurabi's laws. They find their origins in the laws that God gave to the ancient Israelites through Moses. Now, the point of note, the laws that God gave through Moses, they were given while the people were still essentially wandering in the wilderness, but they do look towards a sedentary life, and that's what we get to next. Next point that we're going to talk about is God fulfilling his purpose, preparing for possession of the promised land. Chapter 7, verses 1 to 11. When the Lord your God brings you into the land you are entering to possess and drives out before you many nations, the Hittites, the Girgashites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, seven nations larger and stronger than you, and when the Lord your God has delivered them over to you and you have defeated them, then you must destroy them totally. Make no treaty with them and show them no mercy. Do not intermarry with them. Do not give your daughters to their sons or take their daughters for your sons, for they will turn your children away from following me to serve other gods, and the Lord's anger will burn against you and will quickly destroy you. This is what you are to do to them. Break down their altars, smash their sacred stones, cut down their Asherah poles, and burn their idols in the fire. For you are a people holy to the Lord your God. The Lord your God has chosen you out of all the peoples on the face of the earth to be his people, his treasured possession. The Lord did not set his affection on you and choose you because you were more numerous than other peoples, for you were the fewest of all peoples, but it was because the Lord loved you and kept the oath he swore to your ancestors that he brought you out with a mighty hand and redeemed you from the land of slavery, from the power of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. Know therefore that the Lord your God is God. He is the faithful God, keeping his covenant of love to 1,000 generations of those who love him and keep his commandments. But those who hate him he will repay to their face by destruction. He will not be slow to repay to their face those who hate him. Therefore, take care to follow the commands, decrees, and laws I give you today. So this is the key point of Deuteronomy as it introduces Joshua. God is fulfilling his purposes. God is Lord of history. And reiterating what I said at the introduction, the timing of the events is related to the sin of these other peoples. And we're just going to jump back briefly to Genesis 15, verse 16. God's speaking to Abraham, and amongst all it, he says this: in the fourth generation, your descendants will come back here, for the sin of the Amorites has not yet reached its full measure. So God is Lord of history. The timing is his, and it's his purpose that is being fulfilled. So this whole business of taking the promised land was bound up in the overarching sovereignty of God. God is the creator of everything and everyone, and he has every right to destroy those who won't submit to his rule. Let's have a look at Deuteronomy 8, from verse 19 through to 9, verse 6. If you ever forget the Lord your God and follow other gods and worship and bow down to them, I testify against you today that you will surely be destroyed. Like the nations the Lord destroyed before you, so you will be destroyed for not obeying the Lord your God. Hear, Israel, you are now about to cross the Jordan and go in and dispossess nations greater and stronger than you, with large cities that have walls up to the sky. The people are strong and tall Anakites. You know about them and have heard it said, who can stand up against the Anakites? But be assured today that the Lord your God is the one who goes across ahead of you like a devouring fire. He will destroy them, he will subdue them before you, and you will drive them out and annihilate them quickly, as the Lord has promised you. After the Lord your God has driven them out before you, do not say to yourself, the Lord has brought me here to take possession of this land because of my righteousness. No, it is on account of the wickedness of these nations that the Lord is going to drive them out before you. It is not because of your righteousness or your integrity that you are going in to take possession of the land, but on account of the wickedness of these nations. The Lord your God will drive them out before you to accomplish what he swore to your fathers, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Understand then that it is not because of your righteousness that the Lord your God is giving you this good land to possess, for you are a stiff-necked people. What we see here is that what the Israelites are going to do to the Canaanites is what God will do to them if they forget him. And if you want to know what it was that the Canaanites were doing, or all these other people, what were they doing that was so bad that they were going to be blotted out, just read what God told the Israelites not to do. Read through all those laws, and wherever he says, don't do this, and do this, that's what all these people were getting wrong. So, to reiterate, as it says self-evidently in that text, God has given the Israelites the promised land because he promised to, not because they deserve it. And if they don't behave properly, he will take it away again for a time, which is what ultimately happened. Chapter 28 details the blessings and the cursings for the people, which depend on their obedience to God and the agreement that he has with them. And Deuteronomy also looks beyond the conquest of the land into the distant future. We'll have a look at 31, 16 and 17. And the Lord said to Moses, you are going to rest with your ancestors, and these people will soon prostitute themselves to foreign gods of the land they are entering. They will forsake me and break the covenant I made with them. And in that day I will become angry with them and forsake them. I will hide my face from them and they will be destroyed. Many disasters and calamities will come on them, and in that day they will ask, have not these disasters come on us because our God is not with us? And I will certainly hide my face in that day because of all their wickedness and turning to other gods. And we read all about that in Kings and Chronicles, for example. God knows the future and is in charge. He is the Lord of history. And even today, we shouldn't have any pity for the people who were driven out by the Israelites. God isn't being arbitrary. They weren't innocent. The whole society was completely depraved and corrupt. Now, as an aside, we also note that God was very specific that the Moabites and the Ammonites were not to be driven out. They were the descendants of Lot, the nephew of Abraham. And God had other specific plans for them, and he had allocated them land. The Israelites were to leave them alone. We see that in chapter 2. And the Edomites, they were the descendants of Esau, the twin brother of Jacob. And in 23 verse 7, we learn that the Israelites weren't to despise them either, or Egyptians. A few other sundry notes we make from Deuteronomy. A testing of prophets. The distinction of a prophet of God versus a false prophet is what? It's whether or not they turn people towards God or away from God. That was the test. It's in Deuteronomy 13, 1-5. And so the point that is made there is the people are not to follow a prophet just because their prophecies come true. A prophet makes a prophecy, it comes true. Next asks the question, does it turn people away from God or toward God? If it's turning people towards God, it's likely that person's a prophet of God. If it's turning people away from God, it's definitely not from God. Another thing is about tithes. That's a sermon in itself, but it's interesting to note it is a concept that predates Moses. From Deuteronomy 26, verse 12, we can see that tithes are primarily for the priesthood and for charity, for poor people. But interestingly, if we have a look at chapter 14, we can see that under some circumstances at least, the tithes of primary produce, the first fruits, are to be eaten, and it says, by you and your household in the presence of the Lord, which is a little bit like American Thanksgiving. Not quite, but similar. So, question here, how accurate is our modern understanding and practice of the Old Testament principle of tithes? I wonder. Sermon for another day. Another interesting note is the concept of a central sanctuary. Deuteronomy makes mention of a future central sanctuary of worship. In 12 verse 5 and also elsewhere, including 14:23, God mentions a central place of worship. He talks about the place that the Lord shall choose. Now, even though Jerusalem was eventually designated as this central place of worship, it's interesting to note that Jerusalem isn't mentioned in Deuteronomy. The future significance of Jerusalem is being foretold back then before the people had ever been there. And the significance of these verses that I just mentioned cascades right through history to today and beyond. Jerusalem is and will continue to be long in the future a centre of geopolitical significance. Deuteronomy 12 verse 5 is where it all starts. So, recapping. Deuteronomy is a renewal of the covenant and a restating of the law by God through Moses. The book sets the scene for the conquest of the promised land, as is described in Joshua. And what all this reinforces is, what is God like? God isn't indifferent to the sin of cultures and nations. Depravity matters to God. Now, we ourselves are not God, and nor are we the ancient Israelites sent to war under God's direction. But we can look at the world through God's eyes, and in doing so get a better grasp of the overall flow of history that God is in charge of. For example, in the early 21st century, I suggest God is not indifferent to the bankrupt depravity of the Taliban or the Islamists of North Africa, along with their sympathisers and supporters. We're talking here about people who shoot little girls in the head for promoting education of girls, and then follow up from that with repeated statements justifying their actions. I mean, it's absolutely depraved moral standards. Nor, I suggest, does the militant promotion and imposition of what could be called diversity of sexual perversity, which is sweeping the Western world in particular, neither does that escape God's notice. And I suggest also that God is very interested in the attitudes of nations towards his chosen people, the Jews, and their ancient homeland of Israel, in spite of all its flaws and shortcomings as a nation. God is Lord of history as much now as ever. So that summary of Deuteronomy we'll go back to in chapter 30 and read it again from 11 through to 20. Now what I'm commanding you today is not too difficult for you or beyond your reach. It is not up in heaven that you have to ask who will ascend into heaven to get it and proclaim it to us so that we may obey it. Nor is it beyond the sea, so that you have to ask, who will cross the sea to get it and proclaim it to us so that we may obey it? No, the word is very near to you. It is in your mouth and in your heart, so that you may obey it. See, I set before you today life and prosperity, death and destruction. For I commend you today to love the Lord your God and to walk in obedience to him and to keep his commands, decrees and laws. Then you will live and increase, and the Lord your God will bless you in the land you are entering to possess. But if your heart turns away and you are not obedient, and if you are drawn away to bow down to other gods and worship them, I declare to you this day that you will certainly be destroyed. You will not live long in the land you are crossing the Jordan to enter and possess. This day I call the heavens and the earth as witness against you that I have set before you life and death, blessings and curses. Now choose life so that you and your children may live, and that you may love the Lord your God, listen to his voice, and hold fast to him. For the Lord is your life, and he will give you many years in the land he swore to give your fathers Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And ultimately, I suggest that though the key message today is those first few verses of 11 to 14. The word is near you. It's not difficult. And this is reiterated again by Paul when he's writing to the Romans, where he quotes from Deuteronomy 30, verses 12 to 14. So So in Romans chapter 10, verses 5 to 13, he says this. Moses writes this about the righteousness that is by the law. Whoever does these things will live by them. But the righteousness that is by faith says, do not say in your heart, who will ascend into heaven, that is to bring Christ down, or who will descend into the deep, that is to bring Christ up from the dead. But what does it say? The word is near you, it is in your mouth and in your heart. That is the message concerning faith that we proclaim. If you declare with your mouth Jesus is Lord and believe in your heart that God raised him from the dead, you will be saved. For it is with your heart that you believe and are justified, and it is with your mouth that you profess your faith and are saved. As the scripture says, anyone who believes in him will never be put to shame. For there is no difference between the Jew and Gentile. The same Lord is Lord of all and richly blesses all who come to him. For everyone who calls on the name of the Lord will be saved. So the closing point that I make out of all this is that the good news of Jesus is that salvation is near. Let's pray. Dear Lord Jesus, we do truly thank you that your salvation is near.